You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
The truck came. It crushed everything in its path. Afterwards, it stopped. The driver was arrested by police who overpowered him.
An eyewitness recalling last night's attack in France. As the death toll reaches 84 with hundreds more injured, we'll assess the political and security situation both in Nice and around the world. Plus...
If, as we fear, this was a terrorist attack, then we must redouble our efforts to defeat these brutal murderers who want to destroy our way of life.
Britain's Prime Minister also vows to crack down on potential threats, but after France's third major attack in just 19 months, how big a challenge is Europe facing? We'll ask the UK's former Minister for Security and Counter-Terrorism. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are all Monocle staff. It's our editor, Andrew Tuck, our culture editor, Robert Bound, and joining us on the line from Northern Italy, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Welcome to all three of you. At least 84 people are dead after a truck ploughed through crowds of spectators gathered in the French city of Nice last night to celebrate Bastille Day. News outlets in both France and Tunisia have reported that the attacker was 31-year-old Mohamed Boulail, a delivery truck driver from northeastern Tunisia. It's understood he moved to France around 2005. Earlier today, police searched a home in Nice with Mr. Boulail's name outside it. Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli is in Nice. He's been reporting for us all day and he joins us on the line now. Danny, thank you very much for joining us right now. Perhaps if you can start by talking us through the situation down at the promenade right now.
Yeah, so I was at the promenade the entire day, basically, and it's becoming a familiar setup, really, after all these terror attacks happen. I mean, in Brussels and Paris, the street is shut down, makeshift memorials pop up, people leave flowers and candles, and they handwrite things, and they leave mementos. So the promenade is essentially shut for the length that the attack took place. It was about a two-kilometer length. On either side of the promenade, bizarrely enough, it's business as usual. People are on the beach. I saw a couple taking wedding photos. It's kind of a weird contrast. At the actual promenade, though, where it took place, it's dead silent. There's not a lot of activity. There's a lot of police activity, though. And it's all just slightly surreal because it's one of the most beautiful cities in Europe, and everybody's completely depressed.
And Dan, you've spoken to some people who witnessed last night's attack. What did they tell you?
So I spoke to a lot of people. I met one American couple, a middle-aged American couple on holidays. They're from New Jersey. They basically are at the hotel right where it all went down. And they went to bed before it happened. They got texts from their family back home saying, are you okay? They had no idea what happened. Then they looked out the window, and it was a crime scene. They're completely devastated, of course. They're going home tomorrow. I met an old French couple that were arguing loudly together. I mean, when I was in Paris after the Bataclan, a lot of these little groups spring up of kind of conversation and debate of what happened, and this old couple was debating loudly, so I went up and talked to them, and they're just completely aghast. They've been in Nice for many, many decades, and they said, you know, this is kind of the end of life as we know it in Nice. And I also spoke with two teenage girls who had extremely graphic video on their cell phones. I mean, you know, I don't know if the young kids in Nice right now are kind of trading these videos, but it's kind of horrific videos that are out there. I mean, they weren't laughing about it, of course, but they showed it to me, and they were driving their car along the street when it happened, and then they stopped, they pulled over, and they just started taking videos of everything. And they're young girls, they're in high school, and they're completely depressed. I mean, they said all of their friends are depressed too.
Daniel Giacopelli in Nice, thank you very much. And we'll hear more from Danny on the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 London time, 2300 in Nice, where we'll have more reports from Danny. Before I bring in Andrew and Rob and Tyler, we're also joined on the line by Admiral Lord West, who's the UK's former Minister for Security and Counter-Terrorism. Admiral Lord West, thank you very much for joining us today. As we said at the top of the programme, this is the third major attack in France in less than 2 years. And actually, there's been a number of other smaller attacks in France during that time as well. Is there a specific French issue here that we have to separate from what's happening with terror attacks or terror threats elsewhere?
Well, I think that, I mean, the French have also managed to unwind some plots as well, some with the help of our intelligence agencies before they've happened. But I think there is a specific French issue. I think they have a greater problem, I think, with a radicalized grouping of Muslims. It's partly because of the setup within France, the estates, these sort of cinque estates all around Paris and around Marseille and places like that. So I think they have a larger pool of very disaffected people who then turn, I think, to this sort of terrorism, more so than probably in most other countries in Europe. They've probably got more. They also have, of course, unlike Britain, they are part of the Schengen Agreement, so their borders are much more porous and people can move across them. It's easier to get in and out of France than it is, say, of Britain. So that is a problem as well. And I think also their agencies, rather like ours were some years ago, still slightly work in stovepipes. They're not as closely linked together as in UK. So I think when you add all that up together, that does give you a slightly greater problem. But let's not kid ourselves. The threat level in Britain is severe. That means an attack is highly likely. If you went to your doctor and he said, well, you're highly likely to have a heart attack tomorrow, it wouldn't half focus your mind.
Well, you say that it wouldn't half focus your mind, but there's the suggestion that actually in a number of capitals across Europe, it seems that minds aren't as focused as they perhaps should be.
Well, I think certainly historically that was the case. I mean, when we were getting our first terrorist incident early on, and indeed the first Al-Qaeda attack, actually, which we managed to stop, was in as early as 1998. The other governments in Europe said, well, this is a British problem. You know, you're the little Satan. You're allied with US. And they refused to accept it was a problem for them. We then actually, as time went on, we managed to point out that it was. And indeed, we saved both Germany and France and actually Holland from attacks at various stages and Norway because of our intelligence agencies spotted them. And I think now they do understand this is a universal threat to the freedom of our cultures in Europe, a very malign and nasty threat to the sort of freedoms that we expect. And I think they do understand that. But I think some of them don't quite know what to how to really focus on tackling it.
Admiral Lord West, we'll leave it there. Admiral Lord West, the UK's former Minister for Security and Counter-Terrorism, thank you very much indeed. I want to bring in Andrew Tuck, our editor, who's here in the studio. Andrew, first of all, let's go back to Danny's comments about how, for many people, in a way, life has got back to normal in Nice. Is that just one of those things that you have to do? You have to react like that?
Well, it's strange that Danny mentioned earlier on today that many people are back on the beach as though almost nothing had happened. I think that's a kind of a tourist thing, and I think deep down that people will all feel some sense of bewilderment and fear about what did happen. And I think it's for the people who live in the city as well that it will be most stark, the contrast between today and yesterday. And I'm sure that they will be concerned, but not least because after we saw, you know, the attacks in Brussels, what turned out to be an individual attack then rolled on. We had many days of people being hunted down, not sure who was involved. And I see already the suspect's ex-wife has been arrested. And I guess the other kind of note of caution around this is we still don't quite understand what this man's links were and with whom. You know, there are some people still feeling only months ago he was a petty criminal. Mid last year, he was arrested on a road rage charge. How did he become so rapidly identified with the jihadi cause? And if he did, is that genuine? Because, again, none of the mosques seem to know him. So he seems to be a bit of a lone wolf character in more ways than one.
Tyler Brulé, if I can bring you in here, you've been following this story all day from Northern Italy, looking at reaction across Europe. That point that Andrew makes there, that, you know, this does not look to be so far, and obviously we don't know yet everything, but it does not look to be a coordinated old style, if you like, terrorist attack, where there is a group, the top-down organisation that has worked out and plotted out exactly how it works. This is we're living in a slightly different age now of terror attacks, aren't we?
It's hard to apply the words amateurish when you're talking about the deaths of 80 plus people, but it does beg a number of questions. Steve, we were talking during the briefing, there's going to be a number of question marks. What was he able just to barrel through what we all would seem to be sort of very light barricades? This is, of course, we're talking about the promenade. It normally functions as a regular thoroughfare by day. Of course, for the Bastille Day celebrations, it was closed. What happened at the top end of that? We're not entirely sure still at the moment. So was this just a case, if we rewind, that a vehicle was rented? Somehow there was potentially some type of engagement with some type of faction, which sparked him or was egging him on, or potentially not. As of course we've been hearing also really throughout the day, as we have more facts on the story, we don't have a claim from any terrorist groups at this point. Oftentimes on ICE's own broadcasts, we would have heard some type of celebration over this. There would have been calls and of course celebratory voices about martyrdom and various other things. That hasn't happened. So I wonder if this doesn't just have security services at the very top end scratching their heads, but I think also at the gendarmerie, at the police, at the municipal end, also wondering what exactly went wrong here.
Rob Bound, this is not just an attack in Nice on French people. It's when you look at the list of people who are dead, there are three Germans, two Americans, Tunisians, a Russian. Amongst the injured, there are Brits, there are Canadians. And, you know, as Danny was saying earlier, you know, this is Nice. It's Nice and it's July and people are on the beach.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those things that it seems these terrorist attacks, all these attacks, whether or not they're aligned to a terrorist organisation or not, as we've been talking, seem to get closer and closer to home the nearer they get to our timeline. Actually, what is the safety surrounding the European Football Championships, which we all kind of like were glad. We all maybe forgot that this sort of thing was likely to happen in France.
Until the final, and everyone's like, oh yes,
and then
nothing happened.
Like,
did it?
Well, we can all be there. And I know that there were calls listening to various media sources this morning. There were sort of calls that maybe this has happened because people have taken their eye off the ball after you know, like a big public event for a month in France has gone off without a hitch, that maybe this happens. Obviously there are protocols in place to stop this from happening, but even so, this is the sort of thing perhaps that you can't police against. How can you police against someone driving a van into a crowd of people? You just simply cannot, especially when you look in the back of his van and you wonder whether these were fake weapons and all the rest of it. There is a sad air of fantasy to the driver of the van, the attacker, but there is a sad unpoliceability perhaps to the incident itself.
And that's the thing, isn't it, Andrew, that whilst, you know, post September 11th we could think, well, we've got better metal detectors at airports and we are on the lookout for this, and now you can't take water bottles on and we'll make sure you take your shoes off. This sort of attack is far harder to deal with. As we were hearing earlier today, there are 11,000 people on the terror watch list in France. Now, it is impossible for those 11,000 people to be watched. And this gentleman isn't one of those 11,000.
No, and yeah, and first of all, yeah, you're right. We're thinking he's a petty criminal who wasn't coming to the attention of the people who could have potentially pulled him off the streets and stopped this. But what we will see is we will see changes in the way that security is run, especially around big events and large gatherings of peoples, and those things are good. But of course, you can't put, you know, the only way of stopping it completely happening is to shut down on all of our liberties and freedoms. And that is something that the French will not want to do. And I think, you know, that just look at the discussion. I think we do have to be slightly cautious to keep on saying, you know, why does France have this problem? Is it a French problem? We should be very cautious because it could actually happen anywhere. The nature of terror, you know, while ISIS has called on attacks on France, partly because it is not a religious society and because it's, you know, had, you know, attempts to stop people wearing headscarves and things, it could happen everywhere. That's the nature of terror. It just wants to hit and disturb and unsettle. So, you know, there is no nation that is safe from this. And I think as we begin to unpack it and, you know, we worry about the causes and the issues behind it, let's not get too caught up on poor them, or, you know, why are these people outside the mainstream? I think in this instance, what we have to be focused on is, you know, these are terrorists. How do we catch them? How do we stop them? And what liberties are we actually willing to give up to ensure that we don't see the likes of this?
And Tyler, if I can bring you in on this point, at a moment where, you know, we're just 3 weeks after Britain voted to leave the European Union, where a lot of countries are talking about being more protectionist, do you have a worry that perhaps, you know, European nations, Western nations altogether, aren't perhaps sharing information as much as they should be, aren't necessarily working out with each other sort of how they deal with these problems? And there may well be lots of people, you know, in London, in Brussels, in Berlin tonight going, well, look, that's a French issue, that's a French problem.
Absolutely, Steve. I think that you only have to look back to late May. You had, I think it was Patrick Calvar, he's the head of the DGSI in France. Of course, it's the domestic security agency, their equivalent of MI5. And talking about just these very serious issues within a domestic context of agencies and, of course, police forces at various levels, not talking to each other, and then you wonder if this is within the confines of France, and then of course we saw the failings between Belgian and French intelligence, then of course you really have to wonder if it is just managing to hold together. And I think many times I can just remember back to November after the Paris attacks. I'd come from a security briefing dinner in London the night that the Paris attacks happened, and was speaking to various advisors, consultants on a number of levels, saying it's just extraordinary in the UK that, and as Andrew's saying, that things haven't happened because so many resources are deployed on just keeping a lid on things. So you do wonder that if we're just managing to make it work now, and I'm maybe saying we from your side of the channel, then you do wonder what happens if there is this untethering. And I want to pick up on what Andrew was saying as well. We should not fall into this. This is the other thing that could happen. We don't want to see political points being scored anywhere, but particularly in the UK right now, to say, well, look at, you know, because of our already slightly removed status, not just geographically, but also politically, maybe even socially, nothing really dreadful has happened, of course, since the bombings of the early 2000s in the UK. And I think that is something which must not happen, that suddenly we just feel a little bit smug because our intelligence is that much better. This can absolutely happen anywhere. And I think what this event points to today, if this is one individual, that we shouldn't forget that Kalashnikovs, you know, this is not the United States. They're not that easy to come by. So we do have to wonder, the things that were found in this vehicle, they're not fake. It is reported they are the real deal now. So it does show that there must have been dealings at some level with some darker elements that go beyond the misdemeanors and offenses that this gentleman of course was involved with.
And just picking up on that point of Tyler's, it was fascinating is you just look at the hundreds and hundreds of young men who went to join Islamic State, and now as Islamic State loses territory in Syria, in Iraq, crossing back into Turkey, trying to make their way back into Europe. Now, some of those people will be caught by border checks and security, but many of them, I'm for sure, will end up back in the nations where they began, maybe not trying to take up their old lives. And we had hundreds of young men go from the UK. Now, the idea that we're going to find all of them as they come back into the UK is questionable. So again, just reiterating that point, no nation should feel safe. This should be a joint collaboration. And, you know, it is a terrible show. And we see the EU is meeting on Monday. All ministers will be there. Of course, the UK will be there at the moment. But we know that many British politicians don't want to be there in 2 years' time. So that role of security, how it's going to be more efficient, and just also the standing shoulder-to-shoulder nature of it is, again, a disappointment. You know, the background of the politics that's being played out in a different story as well.
Rob, I was talking to someone yesterday who used to work in the State Department in the US, who said that every morning when he came into work, he was given a piece of paper on it, which was his security briefing for the day. And every single day, it said, without fail, we think there will be a terrorist attack somewhere today. Every single day, there would be that fear. And vast majority of days, nothing happened. Is it perhaps easy for us who don't sort of live in that world to just think we're safer than we are?
It's one of those funny things. What do you think when you come on the way to work? It depends what the means of transport by which you get to work. If you're on a bike, a bicycle, you probably feel safe. If you're on a scooter, if you're in a car, if you're on a tube, if you're on a bus, you don't feel so safe. Every time when I heard this story on the radio this morning, when I learned about it last night, but especially when I knew I was going to be getting on a bus to come to work this morning, you feel differently about it. And knowing that all four of us are going to be talking about it on the radio tonight and throughout the day, it makes you feel differently. It makes you feel, if not vulnerable, it's one of those questions whether knowing a little bit makes you more or less scared than knowing nothing at all. And I suppose that is the nature of it. And I wanted actually, Steve, to talk a little bit about how the media has covered this, not in a navel-gazing way in any sense, but because this is the prism through which we're all understanding this story, whether we are a part of the media, like we are talking about it tonight on this radio show, or whether we are clicking onto some social media app on our mobile phone on the way home. And this is the interesting thing, and this is something that Tyler and I were trading emails about earlier in the day. It was about the coverage of BFM TV in France, which was a small startup radio station in 2005 talking about business. It grew a TV arm, and now it's had the most fantastic coverage of this. I say fantastic, I mean rigorous and poised coverage of this attack last night in Nice. And it's an interesting thing of what happens when you can have some digest, and you can, rather than going for clickbait, it's shied away from showing the smartphone footage that Danny was talking about in our first answer, and it's been very considered, and it won't talk to someone unless they're live and they're outside a place, and it doesn't seem to be ambulance chasing journalism. It seems to be considered yet very, very live.
Rob, I was just looking at Tyler. Tyler, you dive in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I was up until about probably 6, 7 a.m. CET this morning, watching everything. And just on this very point, picking up on what you're saying, Rob, that there was, it was extraordinary watching BFM TV, but then also how perhaps the news gathering organizations, the rolling news gathering organization that we know so well, the CNNs, the Skies, of course doing, you know, a good job, but just relying too much on the eyewitness account. But the eyewitness account where there wasn't a pre-interview, because there maybe the structure of the newsroom has changed. I cringed at a lot of the language, because it was so raw, and I think that it didn't have to be that way. And we've seen what's happened this afternoon. We've seen the National Gendarmerie in France saying that parents need to protect their children from all of these images as well, because they're horrific images, and that's why we're all here. We're all here as editors, because there does need to be a filter. And I felt as the evening wore on watching some of the networks. First, we're showing you these images, ladies and gentlemen. They're blacked out, they're slightly blurred. And then, of course, there's that temptation in the control room to show ever more gruesome images. Of course, horrendous event, but I think also one has to be, I think, very measured. And I felt that BFM TV, being close to it, being on the ground, I think we're exemplary.
Steve, I was just looking online at Nice Matin, and it was interesting when we saw the attacks in Orlando, how the local papers really kind of stepped up to the mark. And Nice Matin has done a great job since the attack. You know, the coverage has been intense and moderate and, you know, very, very informed. it's really interesting for a newspaper that should have today been probably having a front page about the jazz festival or Rihanna singing in the city tonight. They've managed to turn all of their journalism round. And this is when we talk about, you know, the difference between some of the online media and some of the traditional media. In the end, these traditional media companies are staffed by people who, at the flick of a switch, can go from covering one topic to the next and deal with it in a really detailed way. So I think, you know, it is, you know, interesting to see how solid much of the French media has been over the past 24 hours.
And Tyler, on that point as well, when we look at, you know, the way that the Orlando Sentinel covered the attack at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando just a few weeks ago, you know, this was a newspaper that had lost, you know, a number of members of staff, had been sacked, been laid off, and yet they were still able to, when it came to the moment, they were the people that they had people on the ground who knew what to do. They could find the best eyewitnesses. They really knew what they were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as Andrew was saying, you could even argue in a, maybe not so much in a French context, but maybe the Orlando Sentinel shouldn't even be around anymore, Steve. You know, this is one of these papers that should have been really sort of, you know, put to rest, put out to pasture a long time ago. But you see the importance of having connections, knowing who to speak to at City Hall. How do you reach the police commissioner's office? How are you able to get the right statement? And I think what we've seen throughout the day, BFM TV and Nice Matin, of course, really, you know, releasing the name, of course, of the perpetrator of this attack, you know, long before, of course, the prosecutor's office. That's just good old-fashioned journalism. And that is why, you know, whether it's from a regional context, whether it is in a metropolitan context, it is absolutely vital, particularly when we're talking about issues of liberty, that we have this type of vital press out there.
Okay, I just want to get some final thoughts from all three of you before we go. Andrew, where do we go from here? It's, you know, we can't keep having these same conversations about a terror attack and what it all means and what happens next. It's, I feel like we're repeating ourselves.
Well, unfortunately, I think we will have some of these conversations again over the coming months and coming years. I think we have to be confident that we have our houses in order on a security front, on a relations with communities front. But after that, I think we have to be quite strict about, you know, what is right and wrong. And we shouldn't get too caught up in the niceties of it. I think there has to be action and there has to be an acceptance that at times that is going to involve, you know, listening to people's calls and stopping people who look, you know, as though they may be in trouble, and forcing all sorts of people to kind of step up to the mark. But I think on the other side, it is amazing how people want to heal. We had terrorist attacks in London. We go to New York, and people, that is the defeating of terror. We know that it's the going back to ordinary life that will actually defeat them in the end.
That was on that point, Rob. That was, you know, the defining moment, if you like, of the 7/7 attacks here in London in 2005 was the mayor at the time, then Ken Livingstone, saying, "I'm reopening the tube the very next day. Mm. We're all going to get back on it."
Yeah, there is the defeating of fear with abject normality. I think that's one thing. And I suppose that thing, your friend of a friend that went to the State Department every day and got that memo put into his hand, that is an uncomfortable situation. But beware the day when you don't get it because it's happened.
And Tyler Brulé in Northern Italy, what one final comment from you just about, you know, you've been looking across Europe at how Europe has been responding to this so far today. What's the one overarching lesson you can pick up?
I think what you see in press from a number of areas, Steve, is just this sense that France, you know, does need to knit together its organizations. I think you've seen from a number of German and Swiss outlets, of course, German and Swiss fatalities as well. So maybe there is, you know, at least already, you know, pronounced that. You know, maybe they could have done more. Nice was always known to be a hotbed of jihadism. So I wouldn't call it finger pointing, but I think there's actually been some very, very good analysis in both the German and Swiss press that more could have been done. And of course, we're seeing similar calls from, you know, certainly around the table with Mr. Hollande's advisors. The last thing I would say, though, I thought that there were a lot of uniforms around that table as well, which, you know, which went beyond just the traditional security services, but at the defense level. And I wonder what will be happening with French forces in the Eastern Mediterranean right now.
Okay, Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound, thank you to all three of you. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day and the evening. The Monocle Daily is at 2200. We'll have more live reaction analysis from Danny Jacopelli in Nice, as well as lots of other very interesting guests. The Monocle Minutes will be in your inbox tomorrow, all about Nice. And of course, stay tuned to the Weekend Edition with Georgina Godwin tomorrow. It'll be a very special Weekend Edition. Danny Jacopelli will be joining her from Nice. I'll be on, Tyler will be on, Andrew will also be on with analysis from the day's papers as well. Stay tuned to Michael 24 throughout the rest of the day. That was it for Midori House. My name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.